Are you gay?
Geeky?
Just enjoy hearing your good Judy's dish about the latest in pop culture?
Well, then you're in luck.
The boys of Flame On are here for you.
In every episode, we discuss the topics that entrance us.
Whether it's comics, TV,
movies,
drag queens,
or video games,
we've got you covered.
So, if you're ready for your gay and geeky slice of pop culture life,
then sit back and get ready to
Flame On!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello?
Look, I'm going to level with you. I have my own things to deal with. After all, we are about to have a lovely landing.
The Orphans, an original cinematic audio drama, is now available.
And now, The Orphans Facility, an exciting new prequel series. Catch up with Season 1 with new episodes of Facility coming bi-weekly.
The following episode of Flame On is presented by the Nerdy Show Network.
Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse.
All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by a comic shop.
Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination.
And with the generous support of listeners like you.
To learn how you can support this and other fine geeky programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Welcome to Flame On. I am Brian, your talking bearish sea captain figure here. Although I am joined today by another lovely bearded gentleman, less sea captainy, I would say, only because you don't have the hat. I think. Otherwise, I think you could be a great sea captain.
Thank you. I'm definitely a landlubber, and I should have had a hat because I have my COVID beard and now I have my COVID hair, which is growing out. You can see the kind of balding pattern.
Yes. Yes. It's like your demon horns almost are growing in. You know, you're getting the.
Literally, one of my students said, look, there's like a cloven hoof on your head, which I was like, should I fail this student or give him an A?
No, absolutely give him an A. So for those of you who do not know, because you don't know, for whatever reason, this is Justin Hall. Justin Hall is a queer comics cartoonist legend and excellent academic and historian of all things comics, but also focusing on queer comics. Justin, it has been so long since I've known about you, and because our paths have never intertwined, I am so happy to sit down with you today to talk about queer comics.
It's such a pleasure and honor. I love your work, and I'm so excited that Cena Grace hooked us up and ready to go here for sure. Oh,
speaking of Cena, first question right off the bat.
Are we going to talk dish about Cena Grace?
Honest, did he pattern this off of you? Because the more I look at it,
oh my goodness gracious.
It's Bear from Burn the Orphanage. And I saw this the other day and I looked back and I'm like, wait a minute.
I would love that. I kind of doubt it, but I would love that. That would make me super happy. I'm going to just pretend. I'm just going to assume now.
Let's just call it headcanon at this point. We're going to go with it. So I want to start with probably the work that most people would know you from, which is a more recent piece, but it's very comprehensive and it both captures queer comics history and also some of your own work. Mm-hmm. And I have a physical copy because I think I did the Kickstarter. I must have done the Kickstarter because I don't think – oh, no, actually, I was there a Kickstarter for this? No, there wasn't.
No, that's Fantagraphics. So there's a Kickstarter for the Theater of Terror, one of those last ones.
Oh, yes. No, I have a digital copy of them. But, yeah, so no straight lines for Fantagraphics.
Yeah.
I don't know that this is what you want to be known for or this is like your magnum opus, but damn, this is really impressive and it could do a lot worse.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, it is definitely like, you know, I'm still slogging away at my own graphic novels and such, but you know, in a lot of ways, I think No Straight Lines will be sort of what, I don't know. It's at this point, it's probably my, it's what definitely what I'm known for the most. It actually was a sort of IP that I started as a museum show in San Francisco, Cartoon Art Museum. In 2006, we did a museum show called No Straight Lines, The World of Queer Comics. And it was the first museum show of that kind of material ever done. And then we wanted to do a catalog of the show, and the funding fell through. But it was, so the idea of a book was kind of rattling around in my head. And then 2012-13, I came out, I did a bunch of research, extra research, and came out with a book. And it's been in print ever since, which I think is like in the fourth printing or something. And now I've also been working on a documentary film, a feature-length documentary film, No Straight Lines, which we're at the very, we're actually in post-production now.
Oh, I'm so excited. When I read about this, I was just like, this is epic. This is going to be so fantastic. And I'm so, and so many projects like this, fits and starts, you know, I know how it goes. I'm still waiting on a couple documentaries that I actually backed in Kickstarter or something, and they're, God knows what's happening. But
So
that's awesome. I actually had a question on here I wanted to know. Is the documentary forthcoming? Probably 2021, you're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, we were supposed to really be out by the end of this year, but COVID. So everything's up in the air in the film industry. We were, you know, kind of slated to try to get it into the film festival circuit by the end of this year, and that's obviously not going to happen. So we're now, you know, we're still like raising some the final funds to finish up, you know, color and sound corrections, get the music done, final edits, and then try to figure out how to release it. You know, whether it's going to be a streaming platform like, I don't know, Netflix or something like that, or if we try to go through the remaining film festival circuit that still exists online. But, you know, it's going to be we'll figure it out, but it's probably, I would imagine next year.
I mean, as soon as that's ready and it's ready to come out on whatever platform, I will trumpet the world to let people know, because this book, I have had this for a while. I had flipped through it before, but I don't think I had actually read it cover to cover. And I mean, it's really not the kind of book. It's coffee table type anthology series. Sure. You don't have to read it cover to cover. A lot of great comics history in this, and your work in there as well, which I want to talk about. But specifically, first, your editing work. Mm-hmm. I mean, editing is not the best title, right? I mean, you is a labor of love. You put this together. You did all the research. You did all the you collected it all. And then you edited it. So it's like, you know, that's like the thing at the end. But your text in here, the piece you've written for the introduction, and I love that it has citations too. Every time I see citations and endnotes, I'm just like, oh, it thrills the little graduate researcher in me. But right. It's fantastic. It's a great, it's a great. If you don't know queer comics from anything, this is a great place to start, because you're very comprehensive. I love that you, because you know sometimes queer comics gets focused on gay comics from a kitchen sink. Right. But you really go back further than that, and you talk about the early lesbian comics and then how it kind of evolved into that. I mean, you cover, you know, European gay comics in here. Like, it's really good and comprehensive. I was impressed. I mean, I love it.
Thank you. I'm definitely a, you know, I'm an academic as well and a research geek. So, and for me, it was just incredibly fun to, I mean, at the time when I was putting it together, I was the talent relations guy at Prism. Which is, you know, this nonprofit supporting LGBTQ comics, fans, creators. So I was, you know, running a bunch of panels and stuff at different conventions and kind of meeting all these different people. So and then I, you know, put together the museum show. So at that point, it's a small enough world, especially during that time. Now it's like exploded out laterally in such amazing ways. Which is
the diaspora. You know, it's fabulous. Everybody's off in their own direction, but we're all in the same fleet. It's great.
It's wonderful. And it's so gratifying. I mean, I was just talking to Jennifer Camper about this because there was a day when, you know, most of the queer cartoonists kind of knew each other, right? It was a small enough scene that we all kind of like knew each other. And that's impossible now, but that allowed me to really dig for the history. And I, you know, and go to places like, so I would go to like Last Gasp, which is the underground comics publisher and distributor here in San Francisco, and go through their like, they have these just like this labyrinth of shelving, you know, and like dig through these old underground comics from the 70s and, you know, covered in cobwebs, you know, and I'd find some like amazing queer comic that, you know, I hadn't heard of before, underground feminist lesbian comic, or there was a lot more depth to the history than I expected. And that was, it was continually surprising to me as I did my research. So that was really exciting. And then, of course, after the book is done and now I kind of look back at it, I see even more things that I should have put in. And I mean, it was one of those.
So that's one thing. Every project, every creator, anyone ever who is slaved over something, you know, at the end, they go, I could have done so much more.
Yeah.
One part of this, and it's at the very end, I did find transgender representation in comics, which I understand, even if it was there, it probably is, you know, few and far between compared to cisgender content.
Yes.
But I was pleased, and Wish? No, what was their name? I don't know what I was like. I should have, I actually didn't put this as a note, even though I meant to. I'll find it as we go. But transgender and transgender creators and transgender content in queer comics, would there be like a nice, like if you were going to do another volume of this,
yeah,
let's say,
yeah,
would that be an area that you could focus on? And do you have some good, like, oh, go see this, oh, go check this out, or, you know,
yeah,
from what you know?
Yeah, actually, that is one of the areas that I would kind of rework a bit. You know, trans comics really get going in the early 2000s with Dylan Edwards, Gina Kamensky, Tristan Crane. All that work just starts kind of building, right? It starts snowballing. Oh, yeah. That's
Mish.
Israeli cartoonist.
Yes. Cool.
Yeah. And so all that stuff starts to build, right? Really starts snowballing in the early 2000s, and by the, you know, in 2010s really gets going. And I think trans comics now are really one of the most exciting areas in comics entirely. I mean, it's some of the incredible work being done. Like Bishak Solm just came out with her new book. There's just incredible work being done right now in trans comics. What I should have done is, the first trans comic that I found a comic about the trans experience from an openly trans person, David Kotler's I'm Me from Gay Comics number 3, I believe, in 1982. I may be getting those slightly off, but
that's pretty good reference either way.
It's a 3-page story and it's lovely. And I, you know, looking back, I should have put it in the book, as it was too important not to. And I kind of missed the boat on that. And the other thing is, I should have also included Diana Greene, who came in the mid 90s, 1995, she began Tranny Towers, which was first in the pages of, I think it was Trans Sisters magazine and Lavender Pages, and then also Gay Comics. I think she started in Gay Comics. So she had that series for a couple of years. If I was gonna do it again, I'd go back and pay homage to those two pioneering works. But again, trans comics didn't really get going until the 2000s.
No, and I think that's you know, obviously that's fair. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Not to be too geeky here, but one of the fascinating things historically is actually that almost in every case, the underground or alternative independent comics do things first, and then the mainstream catches up, right? Across the board, certainly in terms of identity politics. But trans material is actually sort of different. Where the first really most important trans character created by an openly trans creator is Rachel Pollack's Coagula from the pages of Doom Patrol. She took over Doom Patrol from Grant Morrison in 1993 and created Coagula, who's Kate Godwin, and she's this trans woman, superhero. And it's, you know, Rachel Pollack is one of my favorite people in the world. She's actually my writing mentor. I went to graduate school to study with her.
Oh, wow.
And she's, you know, like one of the smartest women on the planet. Created this character, and just, you know, has this amazing moments of, like, there's this great scene where Kate is talking to Robot Man, whose his body's been destroyed, and it's just his head is sitting on a table, and she's, and he's saying to her, like, you're not a real woman. And she's like, you know, you're a disembodied head, a metal head on sitting on a table. And you're telling me you're a man, though. So how are you a man? Like, and just this, like, the sequence takes up several pages, but it just completely deconstructs gender and identity in 1993 in a superhero comic.
That's amazing. Right? And yeah, you don't ever get that, right? That's
no, awesome. It's amazing.
Well, I'm going to have to go check that out. I actually have Morrison's Doom Patrol omnibus, and I've been watching the Doom Patrol series, and it's like, I need to get back and go through all that Morrison stuff.
Yeah. I will say that Byrne, after John Byrne took it over after Rachel, he immediately killed off the trans character, along with a bunch of other characters. But
Of course. So when you were going through and preparing all this, obviously you said you've done a lot of work prior with the art shows in San Francisco. But, you know, like with the process of finding all this stuff, like, what did you, collating it and just going through all of it, what did you, like, learn from that experience as far as your own creator work? So did you pick up any ideas, or did you kind of say, you know, I, based on sort of what I'm seeing, I'm going to focus on this now? Is anything like that come up from that experience?
For my own work? Yeah, that's interesting. I think it was one of the big revelations for me was the extent of the material coming out of the punk subculture, kind of in the 80s and 90s. It really starts off queercore or homocore, starts off with the JBs, which is Bruce LaBruce and GB Jones, created the zine out of Toronto, queer punk zine. And there was sort of early cartoonists that started off even as early as that zine itself, like Anonymous Boy. And then you get people like Rob Kirby and Diane DeMassa with Hot Up Paisan that really come out of this punk zine culture. And that stuff was, it's funny because I was actually a squat punk I was living in a squat in New York and Alphabet City, you know, doing lots of heroin and like being a freaking squat punk. So, but I didn't really know about that material until I started researching it. And that was cool to see, like, okay, there was a certain kind of vibrancy and like anger and sort of immediacy to that work, visceral kind of qualities to that work that I found really engaging. And like, I mean, that's true of the underground stuff as well, but there was this, just that little punk and extra energy to it. So I definitely was inspired by that, and I tried to take that back into my own work.
Well, and so, like, you know, to that, I also got a chance to go back through, again, probably one of my favorite, I think we talked about this before we started recording, but the Hard to Swallow anthology with you and Dave Davenport, and other creators as well, but... one of the pieces in there actually, I think, deals with. Oh, I'm mixing it up. I'm thinking of a different piece from Queer, which we're going to talk about as well. But I know you have in some of your work talked about your past and sort of some of the drugs and the. I think from this, my favorite's Buffet, which I don't remember if it had drug reference. It probably did have some, but
oh yeah, like, no, there was drugs too. Yeah,
I mean that really wasn't the point, but it was there.
Yeah, but, yeah, whatever, it's fine.
But I mean, you bring in some really like hardcore, great erotica, and also things that have, you know, your experience. I think the one that's coming to my mind, Birthday Fuck. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is we're gonna give this the explicit tag. I feel like was an amazing true story that I'm like, no, that just does not happen. So. I don't know if we want to go too big into this, but as a thing to maybe look for in here, talk about like working as a masseur. What's the preferred licensed physical therapist? Like, what's the title?
So masseuse is the feminine term. Masseur is the masculine term. However, if you both of those terms tend to be associated with sex work. So if it's just therapeutic, I would say massage therapist is probably
massage the therapist. That's what I'm looking. So yeah, so talk about that one story, and I mean it really happened. You really had.
That wasn't me. That was actually
Wasn't you.
No, that was a friend of mine.
Oh, I missed. Okay, so it was a true story, yes. But it wasn't you. Okay.
So,
but still a great story.
Thank you. So I started. It's interesting. I was doing a series before that called True Travel Tales. I was obsessed with travel. And spent basically years on the road with a backpack. I've been to probably 75 countries.
Wow.
And just, so I kind of, and you know, mostly in the developing nations, and I've, you know, just Yeah. And so I would make comics as I was traveling as well. Like I would, you know, hold myself up in some little shack in Laos, you know, on the Mekong, and like with for a dollar a day, you know, and like, and I would, you know, have my inks with me, which were always exploding in my bag. And I would just draw comics and then collect them when I got home and put them into these true travel tales, which I, at some point I need to collect that stuff. It's almost all out of print. I had one of them was in the Houghton Mifflin Best American Comics. So that one's still kind of around, but most of them are really.
I had a hard time. I looked a little bit for those. And I think there was some random website I'd never heard of that had like a single issue. I'll have to find the link and send it to you. But like, yeah, I was like, oh man, I love traveling myself. I haven't gotten 75 countries, but I would love to, you know, revisit those. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I really need to figure out a way to get them reprinted or to do a collection. So I really like these sort of memoir pieces and biographical pieces and nonfiction comics. And then Dave contacted me, and Davey is one of my kind of oldest, you know, dearest friends from San Francisco. And he's an amazing artist, a tattoo artist, as well as a comic book artist. And I always wanted to work with him. And then he contacted me. He was like, all right, I'm ready. Let's do a comic series together. I was like, yes, all right. He's like, well, but I want it to be erotica. I was like, what? Okay. You know, like it honestly hadn't occurred to me.
Yeah. Why not?
So all right, sure. And it's interesting. I'm really glad that I did that because I'm proud of that work, but it also taught me a bunch of things as a cartoonist. It made me like, I was so into that sort of indie comic style where you like everything you pull back from, you know, the camera's really far back and everything's very kind of flat and detached. And it's a very kind of indie comics from that time period. The sort of, Chester Brown and like, you know, you can't do that with porn. Like you gotta do the splash page, right? You gotta do the money shot. So I like learned how to do like double page spreads and big splash pages and big dramatic shots and, you know, slow things down. I was looking a lot to manga and specifically to the work of Gengoro Tagame, who at that point was completely unknown in the United States. So I was like, I'll just imitate this guy.
I mean, you could pick a worse. Yeah, that's a good role model, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, and no one will ever know. Of course, now he's huge in the States. So I was learning a lot basically by doing erotica. But I wanted to then incorporate. So I did some fantasy pieces. I did a pirate story and stuff. But I really wanted to incorporate my interest in nonfiction and in memoir with erotica. So I essentially thought of a lot of my stories in Hard to Swallow as essentially kind of mashups of porn and nonfiction, either memoir or biographical work, which is what I was doing with True Travel Tales. So with Berlin Buffet, which was created, you know, years later, we did the series. Davey and I did the series for I think three or four years, and then we collected it, you know, kind of 10 years later, basically, and did extra material for it. And so Berlin Buffet was a later piece, and it was I was just trying to be experimental. And one of the things I'm fascinated with is how we as gay men have sort of sex lives that are really sort of hidden and secret, even from very well-meaning allies, right? That even, you know, even people are totally cool with, you know, my gayness
I don't know the gory details.
They don't understand that you can go on an app and like get laid within an hour.
They do now more. They do, like, you know, after, you know, Grindr and then now, what is it? All the apps for straight people, whatever they're called. I don't know.
That's true. Yeah. Tinder.
But no, like, yeah, when those were coming out, when we were using them, I mean, I certainly was on a few of them. Like, yeah, they had no idea.
Yeah. And then certainly things like, you know, but like a sex club in Berlin where you go there and just like fucking get fucked for like hours. Like, I mean,
I had to find the right page to show because I'm not sure entirely who our audience is, but I actually really, I think you captured the spirit of that club and of what potentially would go on there or like a bathhouse with this piece. And I also love the format because you do a great job of just, you know, you've got that single like male figure in the background. But then you have great prose, you know, boxes throughout with occasional other little smaller vignettes about food. Yeah. And so, you know, you're cementing the theme with the title, but you're also kind of talking sort of about your travel a little bit, you know, with the food you've experienced there. Yeah. So I love that it all kind of came together in that piece. That worked out really well.
Thank you. That really does. You just made my day, like, because it's, you're never quite sure if an experiment is going to kind of land, you know. And it, those are each page, the background of each page is a different parts of my body. So I wanted to kind of like present myself in this sort of vulnerable way. And then also, but then not show the sex, but simply write about it. And then add this elements of the food. So, but in terms of the, you mentioned, you know, the birthday fuck, that was a friend of mine who's a sex worker. And I was actually a massage therapist for many years.
Okay.
Up until COVID, basically. But I was not a sexual massage therapist. I have done little bits of sex work in the past, but it never really too much. I did porn. That was
I heard, and I was again. Oh, so we have a bunch of people in the chat. I'll bring up here in a second until you can see who's here. But yeah, Bill Zanowitz is also in the chat. Mentioned that you had done some stuff, and I was like, really? You'll have to, like, you know, if it's still around.
You know? Yeah, it's. I mean, it would not. It would. You would know. You would understand that. I mean, I did it, you know, over 10 years ago, so I look very different. But you would know immediately by the name that I used that it was me. I'll put it that way.
Good.
It's a reference, the name.
Oh, excellent. This is a quest now. You've made this a quest. Well, I'm still looking for that piece, and I wanted to find a page. But while we have a second, let me just. Quick, you know, down here in the little lower third, we got Bill. Of course, two epic beards on my screen right now. Thank you.
Yeah, stroking.
John Westhoff, who actually was looking for the title and the link to the book to No Straight Lines, which I shared in the chat,
okay, so they can
go find that. That's still out there. You can obviously, like you said, it's still in print. You can get that. One of our buddies, James Figueredo, always a pleasure seeing him show up and check out our crazy streams, and then. A blast from my past, who I've actually never gotten to meet in person, even though he came to Orlando and I was there and it didn't happen. From all the way from way down under, Dean R. Curry, who someday it's going to happen. We're going to meet. But so we were talking before the recording, like, you know, queer comics and erotica, they do kind of have a very intimate relationship.
Yeah.
Not an exclusive one, because straight people have queer comics, or they have queer comics. Straight people have erotica as well.
Yes.
But erotic comics. But and that's a long tradition of that. But
yeah.
What do you think about queer comics and erotica right now? Because we're at an inflection point to some extent. We have the culture normalizing. So like sex clubs and swinger things, all these things are becoming a little more like known about, normalized, and even like gay bars becoming kind of gentrified. Like the edges kind of come off in a lot of these spaces we have. With the comics as well, like we're getting a lot more mainstream attention. So how do we find a kind of carve our own space again so we can go back and have that queer indie erotica or non-erotica comics.
Right.
Like, how do you see that evolving? Is it all going to be through Tumblr or Twitter, not Tumblr anymore, Twitter and Instagram, or are we going to have like actual, I don't know. Where do you see that going?
I mean, I hope that we will continue to have print erotica, you know, print porn comics. But I'm sure a lot, you know, so much of it is obviously going to go to the web and has been going to the web because it's it requires so little resources to get it out there, and of course, less censorship and problems with that. So, although of course there are censorship, there are a lot of censorship problems on the web as well. I mean, I'm not a web comics expert by any means, but I think you're right that it'll continue to increasingly go digital, a lot of this material, and that the erotic comics will sort of lead the way for a lot of that. But I guess I would say in terms of queer. Like kind of queer spaces with erotic comics. I mean, one of the things that Davey and I wanted to do with Hard to Swallow was to create erotic comics that were interesting. And this is something every semester with my students, there's this one moment with my students that I'll bring in a big stack of porn comics and slam it on the table and just say like, and say, look, you know, sex and desire are one of the most important, you know, profundities of the human existence. And one of the great mysteries of life. And it's as important as birth and death and all the great mysteries, right? So we should be making great art about this stuff. And too often, porn comics are boring and sort of don't challenge anything. But you can have, you know, porn comics and erotica that is hot and also interesting and challenging and get at these like essential, profound, you know, ultimate mysteries are about human sexuality. And also that, you know, you should never let someone else colonize your sexual space, right? So that especially if you're a woman, a queer person, a person of color, but whoever you are, make your own erotica, make pornography, because, you know, don't let someone else like create your erotica for you, make your own, and people will love you for it if you're authentic with that work. And you know, my students are always kind of like, you know, jaws drop and like, this is the professor telling us to make porn. But I mean, I really believe that. I think it's a profoundly important progressive and kind of feminist thing to do is to make good porn in the world. So,
well, it's all about representation, right? Because yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of the sexual representation, even into the 90s and early 2000s, is just so very vanilla, basic. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's happening. And yeah, there's a lot of it happening, but you're totally missing all of the other gray areas and permutations that are out there, both for practice and for gender and other representation. Like there's just so many varieties that you're not seeing.
Yeah. And you can really play with that stuff in comics as a medium. So one of the stories I have in Hard to Swallow is called Fluid. And it's this femme dyke that I met when I was doing porn. She was writing gay male porn reviews under a male pseudonym at the time. And she said, look, every once in a while I will, you know, strap my tits down and put boy drag on, and I'll go to the back of the Powerhouse Bar, which is a local leather bar in San Francisco, and suck guys off in the back. And I was like, wow, you're a femme lesbian. Like, why would you do that? And she said, you know, there was just this time when I was, you know, really fascinated by the sort of extroverted nature of and just immediacy of gay male sexuality. I just wanted to be part of it. And she said at one point she got caught, and this guy realized it was a woman sucking him off, and he got even more turned on by how transgressive that was. You know, she was turned on by how transgressive it was for her as a woman to go and do this, but then he got turned on by the fact that he was being sucked off by a woman in this male-only space. And so I made that, I just found it fascinating. You know, every time you think you've got sexuality figured out, this some other thing's gonna come around the corner and shake up your beliefs. But I also wanted to make it, so I wanted to make this story challenging and interesting, but also really hot. And so I was able to draw some really, hopefully really sexy cocksucking scenes. And at the same time, really get at these notions about gender and sexuality. And it's something that like would be almost impossible to do with a film, oh, right? Yeah. Like if you tried to do a porn film and you know, adding those levels of complexity would just pop the reader out of the immediacy of it. Yeah.
I'm trying to, again, find the right shot here. But yeah. So evidently that's a thing, and it's called Riot Girls is what I found out earlier. And so it is a known thing. It's not just this one-off thing, but no, you do. And so, okay. So I've had a lot of conversations lately about this and about erotica as a written form and erotica that's depicted on like TV. So take, for example, Lovecraft Country. Okay. Yeah. Which we're not going to unpack all about that. It's a great show. Check it out. But there is so much erotica in the DNA of even that kind of show or like a Game of Thrones or other things that is depicted very viscerally and like, and what otherwise in movies and other media, you wouldn't be able to necessarily get away with, but they don't call it erotica. It's just, oh, it's sci-fi, it's fantasy, it's whatever.
It's HBO.
It's HBO. And, yeah, exactly. That is its own genre into itself, right? Yeah. But like with comics, if you go a little bit past that, like, oh, they're hooking up and then the lights go out and whatever, you're writing like porn. And it's like, it's so funny because you go, but no, that's not how we define porn in video and in any other media. So there's like this weird standard with what we think is appropriate comics. And it's probably partly because of course the whole, you know, Tencent plague and all that era with the, you know, comics code and, you know, how comics are supposedly a childish medium and all that, but, or sequential storytelling is, you know, childish, but like it's so long since that era that it's amazing we're still trapped in that.
Yeah. Structure. No, that's very true. The, I mean, you know, comics are right. They're still associated with children's material, and they will be for a long time. unfortunately. And we're still pissing out the final toxins of the comics code, you know, even years after it's not being used anymore. But then also the fact that it's a visual storytelling medium, right? So you can get away with, you know, describing in prose a certain sexual act, any kind of sexual act, and it not be considered X-rated, right? That the prose, but if you depict it and illustrate it, that's another, you know, visually, then that's another kind of level for people. So I've been frustrated at times about this double standard where prose writers and poets can get away with extremely sexual imagery and it not be considered erotica or not be censored, and whereas cartoonists can't because it's visual. But I would say the difference between it and film, which is of course visual storytelling as well, is that comics demand a certain kind of interactivity. It's a more difficult medium to consume, right? Consuming film, of course, I'm sure film theorists would probably argue with me, but they're wrong. but you know, it's a more passive experience, right? The director is telling you at what speed to consume this media, you know, how to kind of go about it. Whereas comics, it's an allegorical language about time and space on a static page, and so that plasticity, that sort of allegorical distance between the experience of time and its depiction allows for tremendous opportunities. But it also demands stuff of the reader. So, but that in porn in particular, that offers up all these opportunities that the reader can inject, so to speak, their own erotic imagination into the gutters, right? And into the spaces delineated by the cartoonist. And that's really remarkable and very different than film. Because, you know, speaking as someone who's done porn films, when you cut from one scene to the other, that's a very unsexy moment where they're like, the director yells cut, and like someone comes over with a glass of apple juice to get your blood sugar up, and then they move the lights underneath your balls, and like, okay, we gotta get this other shot over here, and like, all right, everybody get set up, okay, 5 minutes of fucking in this position, okay, here we go. Not to destroy the mystery here, but
totally ruined it. I'll never watch porn again.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
But the whereas in comics, you're not encouraged to imagine the space between the one scene and the next one that they cut between. But in comics, you're encouraged to, right? When Gegara Tagame draws this one panel and then another panel next to it, you are encouraged to imagine the transition from that panel to that and inject your own erotic imagination into that. And that's amazing, right? I mean, that's
no medium really does that. It's other than storytelling. I mean, that is, I preach about this to my friends who are like, comics, not my thing. It's like, yeah, but wait, you get to do so much. And some people, that's too much for them. They don't want that.
Yes.
And certainly there's a spectrum, so you don't have to, you can provide more. And anyway, but I love that about the medium. And I totally understand that. It makes more sense that it would be more an intimate experience with the reader.
Yeah. And you can also, it also allows for more kind of mashups where you can do something like have a joke or have like a challenging moment and then go back to the fucking and it not feel like you're, you know, popping the reader out of the experience too much. Whereas in a film, that's going to be more difficult. Pornography and erotica is also a sort of unique genre because there's this expectation of a physical act to go along with it, which is masturbation. And that doesn't have to actually be true. I mean, a lot of people just read or watch pornography or erotica in order to kind of stimulate their erotic imagination in ways that they can use later. But oftentimes it is directly for masturbation. And so, for film, that really limits what you can do with film, right? Because all the directors are terrified of, like, you know, having folks lose their masturbatory experience. Whereas in comics, you can be like, you can have a joke or you can have a weird kind of moment happen, but then the reader can just flip back to the panel that they're really into or the page they're really into and zero in on that and obsess over that if they want to, or move on. You know, their ability to interact with the material and get what they want out of it, whether it's masturbatory or other concerns.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that's a unique property and a delightful thing for comic book fans, obviously. We love doing that. But I want to move on a little bit to some other things that you've done. And this isn't, you know, your editorial product, Queer from Kirby, Rob Kirby. But your work is featured in it. And actually, I think this was one of the ones I read more recently, Seductive Summer. And I think the problem I had is, or not the problem I had with the piece, but the misunderstanding about the other work is that you said you're an LMT and you do, like, you know, a little massage work in this. But what I loved about this is the honesty and the experience that I think some of us have had. I say this not as myself. I've never been in, you know, not love with a straight person, but I've never had to navigate sexuality for somebody so intimately as you did in this situation. But it's very common. And a lot of people have stories. Especially usually with heartbreak, you know, involved. And I really set in Providence. I know you talked about grad school. So did you, why were you in Providence? I'm a fan of Rhode Island. I go there a lot or I've been there a lot. So
that's awesome. No, I grew up in Providence. I'm a townie.
Oh, you've lost the accent at this point. I mean, that's kind of
wicked Akua. I'm wicked Akua.
Yes. Oh. Okay, if anyone's never been to Rhode Island, it's the smallest state, right? Or does Delaware? Which one is Rhode Island's the smallest? I think
Delaware's Rhode Island's the smallest in terms of
a little bigger, but not much. So yeah, if you've never been there, let me tell you about everything's got its own name, the accent's unique, but it is magical. It is a magical place of lots of the ocean and it's I love it. I really do love it. Yeah. Providence is also a fun queer city.
Yeah.
You know, not the most, but it's got some great moments, you know, and compared to what else is around, there's not a lot.
We have a lot of guys coming down from Boston to hang out in Providence because it was more fun.
Yeah. And the drag scene there is pretty great. And they had an eagle. I know they lost the eagle. So that's a whole thing, but you know, but yeah, so this is a true story from your life then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it took place when I was actually, going to school in New York, and then as I was leaving school, I hooked up with this guy who, I think now looking back at it, I think he was actually straight and sort of there's some mental illness problems going on, and he like told me that he was, you know, in love with me, and he came to Providence with me, and then we all there was six of us all living in a 3-bedroom apartment, and none of us had any money, so like there was no light, there was no electricity, it was like, oh my God. It was, yeah.
Bohemian living.
Yeah, exactly. And everything went, you know, very badly. And it was trauma that I kind of like, I was single for 6 years after that. I really, it was awful. The guy, he started hearing voices coming from behind the bathroom door at one point and saying that they wanted to kill him. And then he broke up with me, moved into the other room and would sleep. He broke a banister pole off of the banister and would sleep with it by his bed, because he was convinced that I was going to come in and steal his writing in the middle of the night. And it was one of those situations where, like, I thought if I could kind of love him enough that I would, and it was, that was never going to happen. So, it took me many years to actually be able to tackle the subject of this disastrous relationship. It was interesting. It was actually Alison Bechdel that sort of like made it possible for me. I was spinning, and I just couldn't figure out a voice for it. And then I kind of looking at Fun Home and realizing that the sort of meta narrative where the you know, Alison is able to talk about the work that she's making And so I added a narrative voice that was really, that tried to do that. And so the piece is both one of my favorite pieces, but also like also deeply unsuccessful in some very fundamental ways. So it's a complicated piece for me. It's maybe my favorite, but also I think maybe the most flawed, if that makes sense.
So why do you say that?
I don't think it ever quite lined up. Like, I feel like it was still scattered in ways that I think can be kind of interesting and exciting to read, but frustrate me from a narrative point of view. I never completely figured it out, if that makes sense.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and kind of reread.
I mean, I'll be honest. I just read it this morning too.
Okay.
I don't get that from a reader's perspective, but
okay.
I understand that from your crafting the story and storytelling perspective, that, you know, that's a different perspective.
Yeah.
But it works. And I feel like it's very honest, and it really captures. There's a moment in it that's got some interesting, like, kind of mixed media that kind of took me by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most of it's just your you know, pencil and ink. And I wanted to, like, at least mention that. But do you remember what I'm talking about? It's like...
It's a collage moment, right?
Collage moment, yes.
Yeah.
So that was the only thing in the story that, like, you know, not stood out, but, like, it definitely caught my attention because it's a tonal shift.
Yeah.
Was that part of what you were trying to, like... What motivated you to, like, kind of work that in? Like, what was the thought there? How did you... Or why did you decide to... change that tone for that?
I was making a lot of collages at that time, kind of compulsively. So that was actually just kind of what it was. Like, I mean, I literally took one of those collages from that time period and just put it into the piece. So I wanted to, yeah, so it felt like realism to me, which, you know, and I knew that it wouldn't read that way exactly to a reader because they wouldn't have that experience with it. But for me, that sort of aesthetic and those kind of collages, I was making obsessively for years.
Oh, wow.
So it felt like it was bringing all those emotions for me as the creator.
Oh.
So it felt real in that way. But I tried to be as honest as possible. I mean, honesty is, yeah. I mean, I do try to be as honest as possible with memoir in particular, because what does honesty mean? What does truth mean? It's complicated, but, like, I guess vulnerable and authentic, like, truth is whatever, like, you know, like,
right.
The one character, Melissa, is actually an amalgam of three different roommates that I had. Right.
But for storytelling, you got to sometimes simplify. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't give a shit. Right. Like, I don't care that that's not true.
Right.
What I care about is the authenticity of the experience. As long as I can nail that, So kind of going for that. And then I also want to be vulnerable and kind of, so I have this moment of me cruising a park, you know?
Oh, I love that. I love that because you're kind of vague about it in certain respects, as far as you're describing the experiences.
Yeah.
And I don't want to steal your thunder, but you do something with the visual that I had not seen in this context before, but I think we all understand it. do you want to talk about that? Because I feel like any of our audience on here who's ever hooked up or cruised, this has meaning.
Well, it's interesting also because I feel like it's a generational thing to a certain extent. Like, you know, younger guys, probably have never done this. You know, they're going to be on the apps, right? So why would they cruise a park? Like, I would put on a big coat and I would, like, go down to the, essentially the kind of, you know, the area by the river, and which was a park, and the cars would drive up, and I'd walk up and, like, check a guy out and see if they, you know, if I want to get in the car or not. And so I had this thing where I kind of look at him, and he has no face, right? Because everybody, becomes sort of faceless, you know.
I love that though, because again, it's verisimilitude. Obviously, in this moment, the cartooning is not about the realism. It's not about verisimilitude. It's about the experience, the tone, the emotion, the memory. It's just, there's so many cool things you do with cartooning that a good cartoonist should know and should have that experience. And you know, you're deploying them in this piece. So, you know, again, I commend that because I think, again, that's what elevates. I mean, this one isn't as much erotica. I mean, there's some sex, but it's very, you know. But like it elevates the material to have those moments, to have those tools in your archive or in your archive, in your tool set, whatever metaphor we want to do for tools. But yeah, I really think it's a great piece. And in this work, I mean, again, this is Rob Kirby's product, came out from Northwest Press. Yeah.
Such a great question.
If you can still find it, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Zan still has any copies, but there's a lovely Sasha Velour comic in it, which I actually got to have her sign.
Oh, good. I put
two and two together that she had done. So I love it. It's a nice compendium in some ways to your No Straight Lines because it's kind of the, okay, we have that, and now this is going forward.
Yep.
And so this and the next piece I want to talk about, I love that this is continuing and that we're still getting these anthologies. So I'm going to do screen share for this because I didn't get a physical copy. hold on. It's not the right one. Hold on.
I can at least show that.
You got one handy there?
Boom.
There we go. So, okay. I know I probably read this at some point, and I forgot. So, pardon me. What's wrong? You there?
Brian, I think I lost you there.
Uh-oh. Am I back?
Oh, yeah, you're back. Okay.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I blame the screen share. So I probably read this in the intro and I've since forgotten because I actually this I did not revisit today, but I read this when it came out. How did this germinate? You got Peaches Christ involved, and I mean, you know, she's San Francisco as well, I believe, correct? So
very San Francisco.
How did this all, you know, come about, and what led you to want to undertake this queer horror anthology comic?
Yeah, I really enjoy doing the community building stuff of these anthologies. So I had also just worked with Jennifer Camper putting together this Queers in Comics conference in New York and then San Francisco. So I was meeting this kind of new generation of queer cartoonists that were not in No Straight Lines, for example, kind of too young for that. So I wanted to now do a anthology that incorporated some of the old timers. So this is actually the last place that Howard Cruz was ever published before he died, is in this book. And then Lee Mars and, you know, a couple of the other old timers and the people from my generation. And then, you know, really young creators, some of my students, actually, a bunch of my students. The concept was just, it felt like really fun. Like it felt like horror. I'm not normally a particularly like a huge horror fan, but horror was increasingly becoming a place that was very queer and experimental. And Peaches Christ is the horror drag queen, right? She's like, you know, this like remarkable legendary queen in San Francisco. And so I went to her and I was like, look, let's just have you as a horror hostess as the crypt keeper. She would rather say Elvira, but and then have you, you know, kind of with the overarching story, kind of introducing all these different stories. And I'm really happy it came out. And then I brought on William O. Tyler to help out. And so he co-edited it with me. And we brought in all these different creators. I wrote four of the pieces and I illustrated one of them.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I have the screen share. I'm trying to find the Howie Cruz piece, but yeah, it's William O'Tyler. I love his stuff.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to talk about John Macy a little bit at some point because I know he did a backup for him for Fearful Hunter. Yeah. That is one of my favorite of John's, you know, stuff. But
I did a backup for that as well.
Oh yeah. Duh, of course. And another one I have to revisit cause it's been in a little bit, but, I love the one page sort of here. I'll do a quick little screenshot there. Yeah. Oop, that's not it. There we go. How about that one? There we go. Who did those pieces?
Michael Wirtz, who's so I teach at the California College of the Arts in the MFA and Comics program. But then Michael is one of the chairs of the illustration department at CCA, and he works a lot with Peaches. So with Peaches Christ. So when he heard I was doing this, he really wanted to do something. And I was like, oh, I could have you as the interstitial pages and the end papers, which are so amazing, right? By the way, these end papers, this one costume designer actually made an entire dress for Peaches Christ at the opening of the book launch. Peaches came in this like huge elaborate ball gown made entirely out of that material.
Oh my
with that.
Gosh!
And then bedazzled as well. It was stuff.
She's amazing. I have yet to see her in person.
Yeah,
but it's one of those things. Now that I'm a West Coast person, I might be able to, you know, someday when the normal times are back, we can travel again.
Yeah,
I love.
But I was able to, you know, and I wanted to bring different kinds of creators. So not only just different generations, but also like everything from, you know, Phil Jimenez, who did the cover art, and he's very much a mainstream creator. And Mariko Tamaki did a piece in here, and she does both indie stuff and mainstream stuff. She just won 2 Eisners.
Oh, I know. I was so excited for her. Oh my God.
And Tana Ford, who did the opening story with that, I did the layouts and wrote, and she illustrated, she just won an Eisner as well.
Really? Oh, no way. I didn't even
from
that
Guardian.
Way.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. 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 Okay.
So, everything from mainstream to kind of like the, you know, Howard Cruz being like this, you know, underground comics paragon to, and Lee Mars, and then some of my younger students who really come out of web comics and Instagram comics, and one of them had never been published before, and I was like, yeah, the Bird Tree, Jove, yeah, and then
oh my gosh, that's so I love. We haven't even talked about your academic work, but yeah. I love nothing more than having a great creator mentor relationship. And then seeing like students have been under you and mentee or whatever, like, and go out into the world and get such a rewarding experience.
So this is actually very cool. In Theater of Terror, I got Rachel Pollack, who we talked about before, who is my writing mentor, right? Who had written Doom Patrol, and she's written like 25 different fantasy and a science fiction books. She's like a really amazing writer. And so I got her to write a piece for one of my students, Maya Kobabe, who did Genderqueer. So Maya illustrated Rachel's story with me editing. So it was three generations of us, Rachel, me, and Maya, all kind of mentors of each other. It was just, it felt so like good, you know, like.
All comes together.
Just a line of, it just felt really good. Yeah.
I love this piece. I need to go back and spend more time because, again, it's been a little bit. It's from Northwest. I was on the Kickstarter for this as well, but I think I just did the digital copy. I've pared down. I mean, you can kind of see the library back here, but it's a shell of what it was before the move. But
I hear you.
What other works are you doing? And then also, I do want to touch on your academics, and whatever your current research passions are. But like, are you doing cartooning right now? And is there anything forthcoming that you can talk about or you want to share?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been working on this one graphic novel that Rachel helped me with for a while now, and it's a huge monster. It's going to be over 300 pages, and so it's just one of these things that's just taking a long time. And I keep on getting derailed by doing things like the film, right? So. But I'm still kind of plugging away at it. It's called Castle and Creek, and it's about Kink.com bought out this National Guard armory in San Francisco, which is this amazing building. It's like takes up like a half a block in San Francisco at 14th and Mission, and it looks like just a castle. It's like huge, you know, stone walls, and it's outrageous with like, yeah. And it was vacant for many years, and then Kink.com bought it and was streaming internet porn from it for a decade. And I did a shoot there, and I got just completely fixated on the space, on the building. And underneath the building, there's a creek called Mission Creek that runs from the top of Bernal Heights all the way down to the bay. And it's been paved over everywhere in San Francisco, except for the basement of the armory. It still runs free.
Really?
Yeah, and it floods out the basement during high rains. So, and you can still see like pockmarks on the walls where the National Guardsmen would like use as like firing practice and stuff. So I have this whole like fantasy where if you die in the creek, you become a ghost. So there's a ghost from one of the National Guardsmen from the 1930s And in 1934, there was a what they call Bloody Thursday, which was a labor unrest in San Francisco that really sparks the labor movement in the United States in many ways, of the longshoremen. And people died during this, right? So I've got this National Guardsman who dies, and he dies actually in the creek. And so he becomes, and he's a closet case. So he becomes this sort of closeted ghost that's, you know, inhabiting this space. And then the main storyline is between a young guy that comes up to do porn for the first time, and a sort of grizzled porn daddy that kind of takes him on in a daddy boy relationship. But that relationship is being haunted by this ghost, this closeted ghost. And then I weave in other parts of San Francisco history and comics history. I've got a whole kind of parody of the Golden Age Wonder Woman, which in the book is created by an underground lesbian cartoonist in the 70s, about Wonder Woman goes back to Paradise Island, and Steve Trevor becomes the power sub bottom that he was always meant to be, and Ed Kennedy becomes the Dom Daddy Dyke that she was always supposed to be. So
love it.
So it's really weird and really queer, and I'm kind of slogging away at it, right? Then there's the film, which again is close to completion. I'm really excited to get out in the world. It features Alison Bechdel, Howard Cruz, Rupert Kennard, who created the first queer black characters in comics, Mary Wings, who created the first lesbian comic in 1973, and Jennifer Camper, who's, you know, such an amazing creator.
That's awesome. So you were able to get Howard, and you got interviews and all that. That's so great.
Yeah, we spent a weekend with him and Eddie at his home. So this film means, I mean, obviously I've been working on it for a long time, but it means so much more now because of Howard's passing. Like, he died last year in November, and I was actually teaching in Denmark. I teach at a comic school there every year, and I was teaching my students literally about his work when he died, and I kind of came into the classroom and I just broke down in tears in front of the students. I was like, I mean, because Howard was not only one of the greatest cartoonists ever, but he was also an unbelievably sweet man and just a good person. Like, and those things don't always line up. No. You know? Like,
I was just talking about this last week with Andy Mangels, and then how we have a problem right now that is coming to light of comics creators who were grooming young, usually women. Yeah. They were men, and it's not the norm, unfortunately, to have these mentorship experiences in comics, especially around conventions, that are healthy and So I'm so happy to hear that about Howard.
Yeah, and he was someone who opened doors through his own sheer prowess and artistic just abilities, but then he would kind of kick those doors open and make sure that other people could get through. You know, it's just amazing. So I was able to, and this film I'm hoping will help cement his legacy. Like, because we have such great footage with him.
That's so
great. And then the other thing I'm working on right now is the city of San Francisco, the Arts Commission, hired me for the 50th anniversary of Pride to do a series of comics posters that are going up along the bus stops along Market Street.
Oh, wow.
That's
awesome.
And it's going to be moments of queer San Francisco history pre-Stonewall. So it's starting with, there's like six different moments, and each one will be monochromatic according to one of the colors of the rainbow flag. So I've got like the founding of the Daughters of Bilitis, which was the first lesbian organization in 1955. Got the Compton's Cafeteria Riots. In 66, which were a bunch of trans women revolted against the police harassment, and 3 years before Stonewall, and stuff like that. So, and also the founding of the first leather bar in San Francisco, and the early leather scene. So I'm really excited about this. Like, I'm working on the last two of them now, and I've just been doing deep dives into San Francisco queer history, and actually, some of these people are still around. So I was able to talk with Tamara Ching, who was one of the trans women who was around Compton's Cafeteria during those times. And one of the last leather guys, Mike Caffey, from that Toolbox era. So it's been super exciting, and I want to do more of that sort of thing. So that's the stuff I'm working on right now.
Justin, you are so busy, and I love hearing this. especially with what's going on in the world, because, you know, there's this whole existential crisis people have about what's going on. And it's like, well, you know, if we don't know if there's tomorrow, we better get busy. You know, we got to do this. We got to get these things out there. And like, all of this is so rich. And it what blows my mind and makes me even happier to finally connect with you is that you're honoring queer history in so many ways that I feel like our generation and maybe younger, they don't always connect or don't always know, because a lot of it was lost from the AIDS epidemic and just people getting old. And there's so much there to explore and know about. And like, you're doing that through your comics and through your work with the city. I mean, and as an educator too. I mean,
I agree with you. Like, I mean, I feel passionately that, you know, both comics history and queer history tends to get, they both get swept under the rug, right? Or get ignored or become invisible. And, you know, if we're as cartoonists, we should know about the history of this art form, and which is really quite remarkable. And as, you know, queer people, we should know, we need to know about the pioneers that made our lives possible now. Like, it's breathtaking how far we have come. And that's because of people doing really, being incredibly courageous.
Yes.
So I definitely want to pay homage to that as much as possible.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be well received by the community too, for seeing all this. We did have another comment, and it's actually a question for you. So I want to make sure we feature it before we wrap up. And of course, you know, he corrected it in a second. So Justin, what device do you have for new illustrators who want to get their work out there or standing out from the countless queer/bear illustrators out there?
Yeah. It's interesting that there's been such a kind of an explosion of queer comics work and illustration work now, which, you know, again, was not true not that long ago. And that's just really exciting to see. But I would say that in general, what I find generally lacking is interesting narrative. So if it's one thing to be able to do like really interesting, you know, kind of engaging illustrations that are exciting. But what I find less likely is interesting narratives that really can challenge people, can make us think about categories of identity differently, just that have dramatic tension to them, have genuine humor to them. So I would encourage for cartoonists to really think about the writing, you know, think about the storytelling. Comics are a storytelling medium ultimately. So now, and especially with the kind of bear stuff, there's also a lot of, you know, just people just doing illustrations, and that's fantastic. And what I would suggest, and that is not particularly narrative, and that's also completely viable. For them, I would say, you know, really think about other influences, right? We tend to sort of follow the pack. And a lot of the influences right now, particularly in bear illustration, is coming out of Japan, which is wonderful. We're talking about how that stuff was really unknown in the United States until fairly recently. But now that the Bada Gekomi style has really become incredibly popular globally, which is wonderful. But, you know, Tagame himself was influenced by a cartoonist named Bill Ward, and who used to do a strip called Drummer in Drummer magazine, which
was the
premier like leather magazine. And so I was just looking over, a friend of mine and I were just talking about Bill Ward and what a remarkable artist he was, and looking over his work. Go back to some of that stuff. Like, go to the stuff that Tagame was being inspired by. You know, look at some of those early cartoonists, and you know, so not just Tom of Finland, who gets all the kind of rewards, but look at, you know, Chuck Arnett and Mike Caffey and Bill Ward, and, you know, see if you can find inspirations there, and then look beyond that to other kinds of work, and other ways to draw. There's, you know, infinite amount of ways to draw sexy men, right? But if you can kind of, you know, figure out another angle to it, then that's can be really helpful. And something that will be feel authentic from your own experience.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because it is easy to fall into sort of these style trends that you see, and especially with webcomics, that is very evident.
I'm lucky in the sense that I'm not a particularly good illustrator. And I mean, I'm okay, right?
You do a fine job. You're that rare combination of really talented illustrator who doesn't go showy as often, but you also have the storytelling chops. So that doesn't always
coincide. I definitely think of myself more as a storyteller. I'm okay with illustration. I'm never going to have that sort of like innate sort of, you know, like when watching Phil Jimenez draw is like, okay, that's a whole nother level. But I can hold my own for the kind of stories I want to write for the most part. But the advantage to that is that I can't really follow any trends because all I can draw is like myself. I can't really change my style. I'm not good enough to do that.
Well, at least it's so a pleasant enough figure. I mean, at least a pleasant enough figure you're drawing. So it works.
It's all right. Yeah, but it was like I did this series called Dadville, which was a series of illustrations that I made as cards and stuff. And it's Welcome to Dadville. And so I use kind of like old design and typography from those old postcards from, you know, like Welcome to Kansas or whatever, like that kind of stuff. And I said, Welcome to Dadville. And I drew all these like dad bear guys and looking kind of sexy, but you know. And that was really fun. I worked with a designer, Sonia Harris, who's a dear friend of mine. And she helped me create this sort of distressed kind of, you know, looks like a postcard that's been like worn, that your dad, you know, you find in your dad's closet, like, you know, in his old briefcase, you know, like, and you're like, what's this, dad? You know, like that. So I would say.
Are those collected somewhere or is that just, that's.
Yeah, you can find them on the Silver Sprocket website. Which is an indie comics publisher here in San Francisco. So look on Silver Sprocket for Dadville. But I would say also to the person who had that question before, you know, you can think beyond just the illustration of the bear. Like give it another context, right? Like, so I took my illustrations of bear dad dudes, which I think are pretty hot, but like, you know, adding this other element of like, you know, putting this, you know, putting it inside of a postcard, you know, from like the 1930s, which is really what I was going for, like that gave it an extra little, you know, something else. So you can figure out ways, even if you're not doing full narratives, you can still sort of create semi-narratives, right?
Yeah, I was just actually watching the Amazon show from Tales from the Loop.
Oh, yeah.
And that is based on a sort of a similar idea. I forgot the person's work or name. But it was the same idea. It's images that they drew, and it sort of tells a sort of a story, but with very, very high level loose narrative and just sort of imagery, you know, to suggest that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to monopolize your time. I really am so happy you've been on, and I really appreciate, again, all the time you've got. And when you're getting close to any of these things coming out, we are going to definitely have you back because I want to talk more. I want to do some deep dives on queer comics history with you because I feel like you could do like a whole masterclass series. I mean, you're doing it obviously for your students, but I mean these are great gems of knowledge. I'm glad we can capture.
Thank you, Brian. Because I mean, I love this sort of conversation because when I start talking about like, you know, the queer origins of Wonder Woman or like the first lesbian comics, like my poor husband is like runs, and most of my friends just go running from the room like they see that glint in my eye. And they're like, oh, he's going down a rabbit hole again. Get out.
It is a special gift to be able to annoy your partner with geeky depth. I think we all enjoy that in different ways. But Justin, thank you again so much.
Thank you so much.
And your website's, is it just justinhall.com? Or?
No, that got taken over by some bot or some Russian bot or something. I don't know. But it's just justinhallawesomecomics.com.
And all your social media stuff is probably linked there. And
yeah, it's all links there. Justin Hall Comics and Justin Comics at Twitter. Yeah,
perfect. I'm going to make sure we get that up there. And yeah, again, we're going to get you back on as soon as we can. Thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege. All right. You take care.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.